I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're going to start the show today with the show the government in Baghdad is making over capturing the town of Al-Alam from ISIS. It's part of their big push to retake the city of Tikrit that we've been hearing a lot about for the past week. But if you zoom in on Google Earth, it looks like Al-Alam has about 8 houses, maybe. We often go to reporter Jane Araf in Iraq. She's currently on assignment for the PBS NewsHour in the Kurdish zone of northern Iraq. Jane, why is the government making a big deal about taking this, seems like a hamlet of Al-Alam?
Well, probably because it's been pretty hard to take. It's not just Al-Alam. It's a lot of the towns and villages along the way. And it's been really tough going because they're facing ISIS gunmen who are not afraid to blow themselves up, who have laid explosives almost everywhere along the way, and who are lying in wait for them in Tikrit with more explosives. So they are, yes, making a big deal about it. And part of it, of course, too, is that people have been waiting breathlessly day after day to hear news of this advance towards Tikrit. So this is the most solid thing they've had in quite a few days.
But Baghdad is attacking this area with 30 to 40,000 men. I mean, regular soldiers and militiamen, and they've got air support. Is ISIS basically holding strong because they don't care if they live or die? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that is part of it, definitely. But also they're holding strong because of the territory they're fighting in. Now, this is really a test for the Iraqi government forces. They're mostly Shia. And of course, there's an even greater number of Shia-backed militias. So they're going in to try to take back not only the biggest Sunni city that they've encountered, but Saddam Hussein's former hometown. So really what this is a test of is there enough support in that Sunni community to allow these Iraqi soldiers who are viewed as outsiders, essentially, to take back the city. It's also difficult because this is not regular warfare. These are people who don't play by any kind of rules. And while there is a percentage of the Iraqi military that feels perfectly comfortable in dropping enough bombs and rockets and mortars to level a city, that's obviously not the way the Iraqi government wants to go in this case.
And Jane, some of those Shia militias can be quite undisciplined, and there's a lot of fear that they'll go into these Sunni areas and take revenge on the Sunnis. Any reports of problems so far in that area?
There certainly are those fears. I was talking earlier this afternoon with residents of Tikrit, and they were saying that that's what they're expecting the next step to be. So the big issue here isn't only taking back the city, it's about what happens next. But it's useful to look at why exactly these fears exist in the case of Tikrit. And it's mostly because a military base near there, the Spiker Air Base, which used to be a U.S. base, was where more than 1,000 young men, young recruits, were killed. They were unarmed. They were executed by ISIS. And there are a lot of militia people and a lot of regular soldiers who feel that this is their time to take revenge. The problem is it's not just revenge against ISIS. It is potential revenge against Sunni tribes and ordinary residents who they believe supported ISIS.
As I said, Jane, you're right now in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area, and I gather you've met a fair number of refugees from Tikrit there. What are they telling you? What are their hopes and fears right now?
Their big fear really is that even when this battle is over, they're not sure what they'll go home to. They're not sure how much of the city will be destroyed. They're not sure what kind of security force will be in place to make sure that they're safe.
Reporter Jane Araf in northern Iraq, thank you.
Thank you so much.
You can see the reach of ISIS just by crossing over Iraq's border to Syria. The extremist group has controlled the Syrian city of Raqqa since early last year. And for those who remain in that city, life has been brutal. My BBC colleague Mike Thompson has been in contact with a resident of Raqqa who, for obvious reasons, has not disclosed his name. Here's an excerpt from their conversation.
The people are really suffering. There is not enough food for all the people. The food are very, very expensive. Also, ISIS closed all the organization that's giving aid for the people. The situation for the hospitals are really, really bad. There is no doctors. There is a lack of medicine. The electricity inside the city of Raqqa are also very bad. It cuts about 20 hours in the day. And when the electricity cut, also the water cut.
Mike Thompson joins me now on the line from London. Your contact inside Raqqa, Mike, gives a really vivid description of how hard life is there right now. Does ISIS still control everything?
ISIS controls everything, absolutely. The same man was telling me just the other day that people are still being executed in the street, some having their hands cut off for a variety of offences. And he saw the same day I spoke to him that you heard that interview there, a man was thrown from a building near where he was for being homosexual, thrown from the top of the building. And he said now the general problems with life that he touched on there have got worse. He said there hasn't been now any electricity for 3 or 4 days.
I mean, Raqqa is kind of the de facto capital of ISIS at this point, but it sounds like they're ruling with fear. And is there any possibility that with that iron fist that citizens might even revolt?
He doesn't seem to think so at the moment. In fact, he was saying to me that he thinks it could take up to 5 years before the city could be freed. He said if people are too afraid even to talk to the fighters in the street, and the fighters themselves apparently are very reluctant to speak to locals because many of them are foreign and are very worried about being identified. But he said that if some sort of international force was to try and move on Raqqa, he said there would be enormous bloodshed, which would put many Western nations off. There could be executions filmed, as of course Islamic State is prone to do, and shown on the internet. And he said, if you imagine it was successful, then he says thousands of young foreign jihadists may then start heading home and carrying out all sorts of awful things after passing through Turkey. And he said he'd imagine they'd be almost impossible for Western governments to monitor.
Oh, it sounds like an impossible situation. What about just freedom of movement for this man? I mean, could he, if he wanted to, could he leave Raqqa?
He said it's very difficult to leave Raqqa. It's a bit like a large prison. There's all sorts of roadblocks on all the major roads that surround the city. He said for women, for instance, no woman under 45 is generally allowed to leave at all. And anybody else has to have a very good reason.
This man, surrounded by such inhumanity there in Raqqa, I mean, you talked about him witnessing this person getting thrown off a building, people getting their hands cut off for punishment. How does he manage to keep any semblance of morale?
Well, he seems absolutely determined that the only way what's happening there can ever end is if the outside world knows about it, and that helps garner support to defeat Islamic State. But there's an amazing amount of courage coming out of these people. Only about, I think, about 16 of them. One of them fairly recently was seized and executed after being caught with a phone that he'd used to take pictures of what was happening, executions, in fact, in Raqqa. But he said, the rest of us carry on. We're just ever so careful now. We don't reveal our names to anyone outside of our group.
Speaking with you, obviously, he's running a huge risk. Are you trying to kind of limit your conversations with this man?
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes I find people in his position, they're full of conviction about wanting to expose what's happening. And sometimes in my previous conversations, he said the odd thing that I've had to edit out because I feel it might well help identify him. They're just so gripped, it seems, by the fervor and conviction to expose what's happening that I think sometimes they're opening themselves up to more risk than they need to.
My colleague at the BBC, Mike Thompson, thank you very much.
Pleasure.